Wonderful. Welcome to today's fellowship-wide call, Race and Debt, Experience, Strength, and Hope, presented by the Debtors Anonymous, Underserved and Underrepresented Outreach Caucus, the UUOC. My name is Rivka. I serve on the UUOC, and I am a debtor from Brooklyn, New York, on Muncie, Lenape, Canarsie land. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. Press star 6 to unmute yourself.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, courage to change things that I can, the wisdom and to know the
difference.
We will now put all callers on mute again to silence background noise. The Debtors Anonymous Manual of Service states, the mission of the Underserved and Underrepresented Outreach Caucus, the UUOC, is to support the fellowship in carrying the message of Debtors Anonymous to the debtor in underserved populations and locations. We coordinate with the World Service Conference committees and caucuses by developing best practices for doing that work and sharing it with DA as a whole. The purpose of this call is to create an opportunity to witness people's stories around race and debt as we move towards being a more inclusive and accessible fellowship for all debtors. Today's call will be broken up into 3-hour-long segments with 3 speakers in each segment. This is the first segment of the call. Speakers will be recorded, and the recording will subsequently be available at debtorsanonymous.org/podcast. After the speakers, we will have open sharing at the end of each hour. The open sharing will not be recorded. All callers have been placed on mute. Speakers each have 10 minutes to share. Our timekeeper for this segment is Wendy. She will give a time warning at 5 minutes and 1 minute. Our first speaker is Sarah J. Welcome, Sarah J. You may begin.
Thank you so much for having me. I just really want to start by asking for one of the first DA meetings I used to attend in New York, which is where I'm from. I heard a speaker, a black man, say that he hears people say, you know, we have a higher power whom we choose to call God. He said, I have a higher power whom I choose to call frequently. And so I am going to call on God throughout this opportunity to share experience, strength, and hope as a member of Debtors Anonymous. Since I want to say it was about 2013, maybe 2012, when I first started coming around. And I am a black woman of mixed race experience. What that means for me is that I did not know that my mother wasn't white. She's white appearing, but she's actually mixed race. And I didn't have clarity about that when I was growing up. But my father is clearly, as we say, black from a distance, African, you know, black man. And he's a black American, and my mother's family, Irish American, German American, both Christians and Jews on the white folks and on the white folks side. And my grandfather was people from the Caribbean. So when I add all of those people together, I get, you know, the legacy of slavery and enslaved African people. Irish potato famine, the persecution of Jews, you know, the ongoing issues of white supremacy that I believe in some ways brought my parents together, because my father's internalized racism and sense of being unworthy in a country that was sending him that message all the time. He grew up in the south of the United States with hoses and dogs and all the stuff that I didn't, you know, understand, but I now know I inherited through, you know, genetics and just inherited trauma, post-traumatic slavery disorder, I've heard it called. I've heard just about, in general, having the trauma of our ancestors passed down to us epigenetically. And, you know, on another meeting, I might worry that someone would flag a tradition and say, what does any of this have to do with debting? And I would say that these are far from outside issues for me. They are inside issues. They are the issues. I've heard it said, the issues are in my tissues. You know, I have all of this trauma that for me is collectively, inheritance. This is the inheritance that I believe most, well, I'll just speak for myself. I did not know that my father's insecurities and fear around money, my mother's deprivation, I can't diagnose or, you know, take anyone's inventory, but I do know that I grew up in a home where the fears around scarcity and lack of money mingled with both my parents being doctors. And I don't always share that because I don't, you know, think it's relevant all the time, but it's relevant in this case because my father earned a high salary but would get pulled over by the police who assumed he had stolen his own car because it had doctor's license plates on it, MD tags. That's what the mixture of, fear and danger around white supremacy and violence and trying to prosper in conditions that made it very difficult for my father. I think that was passed. I know that was passed down to me in overt ways, things he said. He would walk into department stores with us occasionally when we went on a big shop and loudly proclaim, kids, get everything you want in every color, so that people would think highly of him, that he had money and wouldn't just automatically assume that we were stealing. I'll tell one more story about my dad. I want to be mindful this is only a 10-minute share, but I really want to give some context here. He would talk about, how he would – I said he would get pulled over. What I didn't say is he was a doctor in an emergency room, and white patients at this mostly white hospital would assume he was an orderly and would say, get that orderly away from me. So this person's prosperity and his ability, the miracle of his becoming a doctor in the first place in the 1980s, was constantly in what I saw as a small child was a lot of mixed messages around abundance, prosperity, and debt. And my father was a debtor, but more than that, I think he just didn't have the ability to function in this society more broadly, and that manifested in his money. I'll just briefly say with my mom, I believe that her experience of being white in the world, white passing, and, you know, having white privilege, gave her a mixture of a sense of disloyalty to her brown skin. You know, she has mixed race. I have mixed race aunts and uncles who literally, my mom is old enough that she had to ride the front of the train with my grandmother in the South and the rest. Thank you. And the rest of the family rode the back of the train. So just, I want to plant all of those messages around race and money. And I know that, you know, I've gotten a lot of support in Debtors Anonymous from people of all backgrounds, because this disease is, I've been taught that if I have issues with money, they're really issues with people. It's really my fear of people. It's my codependency. It's my fear of standing in my own power around others, or my tendency to, just live in the unmanageability of trying to control everything around me. So instead of, asking for what I'm worth, I might not invoice on time for my work. I'd rather debt and put something on a credit card because I'm afraid that someone will think I've gotten too big for my britches if I ask for the money I've earned, stuff like that. And it's compounded as a black person and as a woman. So I want to bring all of that to my current present moment. I am sitting in a beautiful location. I live in Southern California now on unceded Tongva land. That's important to say. But the city is called Los Angeles. And I'm very aware that, for example, the home I bought had a restrictive covenant on it that said no black person could ever own it. And this home was built in the 1960s. We're not talking about the 1800s. That is relevant because I didn't think I could own a home for a long time because of my own debting and under-earning beliefs and behavior over many years. And then it is interesting that because of these programs, I learned to, as I said, believe in a higher power whom I chose to call frequently. And by working steps in this and other programs and, having PRGs, giving PRGs, learning to become a more responsible business owner. Gradually, I own a business and I'm in the entertainment industry. And the truth is, I'm one of the best people there is at what I do, and I know that, and I can say that today. But the feeling of I'm not allowed to own my power and my worth and my value is something I have to bring God into every day, or I will live in lack, scarcity, deprivation, and energetic debting. For me, it's not about, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loan debt or whatever other debts that folks have. I really relate to that. But I've been taught, at least for me, that my debting and my under-earning are very connected. And a fellow who I really appreciate shared this with me. I can't earn my way out of under-earning. There is no way that my spiritual malady can be healed just because I learned to, keep my numbers in DA or because I get a windfall of money. What I really have to do is work the steps with a sponsor so that my spiritual malady, all that inherited trauma, all of the resentments. I remember somebody saying to me, and this was a white man, a PRG man. He said, you know, Sarah, if you can write down, pray, meditate, and ask your highest power to send you the number of how much you are worth per year in the marketplace, write that number down. And then write down the number that you are earning per year, do the subtraction, and the remainder is your resentments. And it blew my mind. I share it all the time. I knew I was worth $1 million. I knew I wasn't making anything near $1 million. And so I got to start praying to God, why am I leaving this on the table? What is it that I'm telling myself about my worth and value that, you know, I can't connect these dots? And the bottom line is I can't do it, but we can. We as a program, we as me and my highest power, we can. And I have increased my earnings while being in DA. And I'm in the sister program as well, the time program. And I also just want to say that white man wasn't factoring in the fact that, yes, a lot of what I leave on the table is my resentment, but a lot of it is white dudes not hiring me, white dudes getting paid twice as much as I do for the same work that I do. So instead of letting my frustration and resentment, you know, racism and sexism and all of it, you know, homophobe, all of it, way above my pay grade. But God, the only thing bigger than the legacy of racism and all this trauma that we're collectively walking around with on the planet, in my opinion, because it doesn't help white people either. I mean, I watch my mother and my mother's family and how, you know, whether you believe the illusion that you're inferior or superior, either way, you're out of alignment with God. And so the only thing that I can do about these realities so that I don't get sucked into, you know, unmanageability and rage is to turn over all of these, you know, social justice issues to God, show up and do my footwork every day, and pray to allow in the abundance of this beautiful spa where I am right now. And I'll just wrap up with this. Abundance looks like knowing my truth and following, heeding my highest power's guidance for me, no matter how terrified I am. And I'm sitting here at this spa where I was supposed to be on a weekend with my abundant boyfriend, but I got some clarity over time that he's not as abundant as I thought he was in lots of ways, and he can't meet my needs, and that is a DA issue. Thank you. I'll wrap up. That is a DA issue for me. It is an issue of abundance and prosperity if, you know, every relationship in my life is not moving as fast as I can toward God and seeing who can really keep up, then I'm not telling myself the truth. So I wish everyone moving toward God, telling yourselves the truth, trust God, clean house, do service. And thanks for letting me share.
Wow, thank you so much, Sarah J., for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Our next speaker for the hour is Lyle. Lyle, if you're on this call, please unmute and welcome. You may begin. Lyle, are you on the call? It's possible, Lyle, if you're not on the call.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, welcome. You may be
heard. Hi, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Lyle, debtor under earner, covering this program. Thanks to the previous person who spoke, which is really powerful to hear. And it's a 10-minute, correct?
Correct. It's 10 minutes, and our timekeeper, Wendy, will give you
okay,
time
so, great. I would like to take the first 30 seconds for for people to unmute and just, I will, it would be good to hear voices who's here, just maybe can you do popcorn style, to hear some names just to create community. So we're not speaking to like a vacuum. So.
Hi, Kyle. Hi, Michelle.
Diana. Oh my God! Thank you so much. That was so warming. I'm just really grateful to be here. Grateful to be speaking from the city and to the country where our First Nation people, you know, were decimated, and speaking to the abundance of the continuation of their legacy in their lives, and also to the 1619 project of the first enslaved Africans who were brought here and the legacy and the foundational work they have made in creating this country. And contributing to the creation of this country in every sphere. So thanks, Patty, for inviting me to share. Today's my birthday. I'm 57, and I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to have the program. And I thought I would, at the encouragement of my sponsor, I thought I would just acknowledge the fact that I've been stalling on 9 steps. I just want to just use it as a way to talk about that in regard to the topic at hand. I am identifies American, African American, from the Afro diaspora community. I've been fortunate enough to live abroad, to have a South African father who raised my brother and I. Stepfather, my biological father, is from St. Kitts, so there's the Caribbean as well. I've also lived in Ghana, West Africa, for 7 years, so I definitely consider myself, as well as Tanzania, as a child. So I was deeply fortunate to at once come from the great tradition of the Afro-American culture, but at the same time to have a global sphere and experience as well. I thought I would start off by just sharing, again, it was powerful to hear the previous qualification. I echo a lot of the deep sentiments in that. I thought I would just share with you a letter, because the reality is I am a debtor, and it's cunning and baffling. I'm deeply grateful for the expansiveness of my life through working in the 12 steps, a day at a time, you know, through being in relation with others for multiple communities over the last 20 years. I'm going to share with you, I'm also calling from Manhattan. I was upstate where I bought a house right before the pandemic, and I was going to stay up there and not come down, but part of me being a debtor is I want to isolate. So I pushed myself to come down. I had a lovely dinner party for 8 people yesterday. My mother and my aunt, 80, my mother's in 85, my aunt who's turning 80 this year, my other aunt is 87, plus my brother and a couple of friends are coming over this afternoon within the hour, and then I'll have dinner with a few friends. And that, for me, is a creating community and really trying to reach out as opposed to isolating. But I thought I would share with you a letter from my an amends I made to my grandfather as a way to talk about where I'm at today. Dear Grandpa, this was written in the last year and a half. My grandfather died in 80, he died, excuse me, in 98. And a very close relationship with him. So, but this is an amends I made, a living, written amends I made within the last year. Dear Grandpa, I'm writing you to express my deepest gratitude for the gifts of life you gave me. Thank you for the acceptance of love and a safe and abundant family home that was filled with a love ethic. Thank you, Grandpa, for guiding us in a way of humility and respect for beauty, Black African beauty, and a safe home where there was love, acceptance, and modeling and nurturing, a high regard for making affirmative, beautiful images and visualizing Black people in an affirmative, healthy way. I'm grateful for all your support and pursuing art after economics didn't work out for me. I just want to let you know that I have deep gratitude for all of your support and making amends for asking you to buy a suit for my second show exhibition in 1996. Despite my disappointment and embarrassment when you said no at the time, I'm deeply grateful that you did. 2 years later, I was 12 steps into DA by my cousin, Cousin Peggy. So I just wanted to just share that because...
That's 5 minutes.
Thank you. The letter, thank you. The letter speaks to just the... My grandfather, I'm a professor at a university in New York, same university my grandfather went to 80 years ago, and he was an economist and dealt with intense level of racism in all spheres, and brilliant man. And despite all that, you know, there was such a deep, deep sense of, like, say, community and love in the family. And not only love, but also the love for the church, the love for community, love for history, et cetera. And he created a sphere. My family created a sphere that we felt safe. So I just want to just sort of say that. But despite that, I am interested what was a part of me, I don't know, a part of me that felt that I could not take care of myself. And I definitely can identify a lot of things were shared, you know, earlier, in terms of those messages I was receiving from society. But I am so grateful that he said no, because it pushed me to somehow be much more engaged. First of all, the bottom out, you know, and because I think in a lot of ways I had holes in my pocket. And what that no allowed me to do was to somehow come into program and to realize that I have the capacity for all of my the love that I experienced in the family. There was a certain sense of, let's say, that I'm not sure if it came from, clearly from society. I mean, clearly we were, you know, the analysis of racism and the culture of classism, et cetera. And, but what it meant to at once to be shielded that, from that, at the same time to have those messages, you know, as was shared, to come in cellularly, et cetera. And I think in a lot of ways that no, helped me to somehow get right size, to realize that I have the capacity, the brilliance, the intelligence to be able to ask for what I, you know, for what I need, as was shared, with God's help, and to really be in community, you know, with others. So I don't know. It's, you know, I'm 57 today, and I'm just thinking about how much I respect this next generation in terms of, like, I come from a generation where, if we went to the right schools, if we did X, Y, and Z, that we would get over. In actuality, you know, my students in this next generation, if you think about the whole BLM movement, just in terms of, like, occupying with the bodies and putting the bodies in the line, similarly in which my mother's generation was. So I'm just really grateful the fact that not only, and mostly my sponsor, a BIPOC sponsor who said, I can claim more, because it was easy for me to hide up behind art, et cetera, as opposed to speaking truth to power. And I'm so grateful the fact that I'm able to do it in a way that's direct, you know, and humble, at the same time claiming more space, you know. So what else do I want to say about that? I don't know. I'm just thinking about where we are right now at this particular culture moment. I know for me at age 57, I need to be thinking about what is the next level of service, but also as I begin to retire and to be thinking about, I definitely need to be in a situation where there are warm bodies, brown bodies, and a warm heart. I know that as far as this culture, there's certain things I can contribute to this culture, et cetera, but I don't think I can be, and people have woken up in a way that is unprecedented. But right now, how do we begin to start thinking about how do we begin to, like, love ourselves much more deeply, being able to take much more space, and also, as was shared, in terms of, like, claiming our legacy. If you think about how all of us has been duped by the educational system, the fact that, I mean, 2022,
1 minute.
Thank you. Thank you that we would be dealing with the inability for people to reckon with voter suppression. So the question is, how do we care for our hearts, ourselves, our community, at the same time to speak truth to power, but also be thinking about how do we also heal ourselves in the finest ways in which we can actually nurture and retire. So that's some of the things that I'm thinking about. How do I use the program, the 12 steps, my relation to higher power, and my multiple community to be thinking more expansively and speaking truth to power at the same time thinking about spaces of healing and also of caring and also loving. And that might be mean occupying multiple subjects as well as geographic positions as well. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that. I'm grateful to be part of this fellowship. I'm grateful for the healing energy and for the solvency and also for the expansiveness and also for, you know, for the 12 steps. And so that's it for me. I appreciate it.
That's time.
Thank you so much, Lyle, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. Our third speaker in this segment is Tereska. Tereska, welcome. You may unmute yourself and begin.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Thank you. My name is Tereska, and I'm a grateful, compulsive spender, debtor, and underbeer. I am a descendant of the first people of Southern Africa, the Khoi and the San. I also have mixed blood in me, so I have European blood, Bantu and Nguni blood running through my veins. I want to thank the UUOC for asking me to share today because white fragility and white denial is real. So as scary as this is for me, I'm stepping up. It kind of feels like, especially because it's a phone meeting, there's a lot of fear. It feels like, you know, I'm stepping into a dark forest and there could be the Ku Klux Klan around. I don't know, you know, so the fear is real and I need to acknowledge it. And I just want to start with a quick prayer because I'm extremely nervous and I just want to connect with my higher power. And I'm going to say it in my mother tongue. Hemelse Vader. Wees asseblief saam met my. Hou my hand, praat deur my en laat U wil geskied. Amen. Thank you. So, a quick disclaimer. I just want to acknowledge that I do not blame my dating behavior on apartheid or racism, but it has definitely played a huge role in my life, and it continues to play a big role. Because ever since the Europeans landed on the Cape Shore, it affected me. There was a genocide of the first people, and I'm still dealing with the repercussions thereof. It has affected my grandparents. My father, for instance, my grandfather worked on a farm. He was never paid with money. He was paid with alcohol. My grandmother worked in the kitchen and she was paid with food. They were told every single day, you should be grateful. We are accommodating you and you have a roof over your head and you can take the leftovers home to feed your family. So when my father was 14 years old, he said, I ain't having none of this. I am leaving to make a name for myself. And he left the farms to go and work on the railway. He was a young boy. He hardly had a grade 4, but he was hardworking. And as a child, I remember him telling my mother while they were sitting in the bedroom, telling him, crying on her shoulder, saying, I don't want to work for a white man. I don't want to work for a white man. I was a kid. I didn't know what that means. But I was born in the height of apartheid in 1976. And it was, I can just imagine the oppression that my father and everyone suffered. I mean, they lived in a time, in apartheid, what they did is they would separate. It was, apartheid basically means separation. And they would separate white people, Asian people, colored people. I'm regarded as colored because I'm regarded as not white enough, nor black enough. And that definitely added to my identity issues. But if you're a person of color and you are outside of your, what we call township, after 6 p.m., there would be a siren going off, and if you are still in the white suburbs, you can get locked up, and you may disappear, and your family may never see you again. So they had to carry around these tags, we call them the dompas, that had your identity and would stipulate which township you belong to. I cannot imagine what that must have been like for my parents living like that. Whenever I would ask my father about apartheid, my father would just pick up a drink and cry and walk away. I believe that definitely added to his alcoholism. So 10 minutes is hardly enough to tell my whole story, but I just want to tell you, for instance, how institutionalized racism has had an effect on me and people of color in South Africa. In this township that I grew up in, my father was such a hard worker. My mother, too, she quit her 9-to-5, and they started a business together. As a child, I hardly ever saw them during the week, but I knew they were at work somewhere taking care of us. But I was emotionally, I was neglected. You know, on weekends, my brother and I would only see them if we go to the shop, which they owned, you know. So they were hard earners, and that has affected my work ethic today, which is why I'm in the work program as well. I remember when my mother gave birth to my baby sister, he bought her a brand new Mercedes. In the house, we were happy, but when they threw a party and invited family and friends, I could see jealousy. I saw the hostility. In fact, one morning, I think it was a Christmas morning, and my father had to lock up the shop because it was open 7 days a week. I was there. I was probably 10 years old, and it was midday, and he was closing the shop. And a customer, thank you, Wendy. A customer came up and cussed my father out for closing the shop early. And my father ignored him, and we went to the back to close up there. And when we came back to get inside the car, my mother's brand new white Mercedes was scratched all around. So what I got from that as a child, that being black and being successful is a bad, bad thing. There were nights when I used to pray that our shop would burn down because we could afford to go to the coast once a year and go on a family vacation. Nobody in my environment that I knew of could afford to do that. We went to private schools. Nobody else, a few people that I knew of could afford to do that, you know. So that definitely messed with my underbeing. It told me that I was not good enough to have luxuries, to live a life of prosperity. In fact, the education that I received in the township schools, it was in our textbooks, how black people were inferior to white people, and the only thing we could do was aspire to being white and living white lives. So that is where I come from. And I got into DA in the height of the pandemic, 2020 in June. I came because a boyfriend that I was dating dumped me. He wanted nothing to do with me, and I was, like, say, a quarter of my finances relied on him. He used to help me out. So I did not even miss him. I couldn't care about him. I was worried about food, how I was going to make ends meet, raising my child on my own. And that's how I come into DA. I am now, the 4th of February, I was 10 months solvent, which is great. I was never into a lot of debt. I'm basically just an under-earner and an under-beer. But for this short space of time, DA has changed my life. But what I want to put emphasis on is not financial debting. I have this amazing sponsor, and I think she's on the line. And I just want to say to you, you are sent by God. Thank you for being in my life. My sponsor has made me aware of what is called emotional debting. It's not just about the money. Every day I debt psychologically and I debt emotionally, and that definitely is a result of living in a racist dystopia, as a friend of mine likes to call it. You know, I debt by beating up on myself mercilessly. I debt by hiding and not speaking my truth. I debt by underbeing. I'm an artist. I'm a performer. I am a brilliant writer, but somehow it's not manifesting in my life. Since I was little, all my family members, everyone in my community used to tell me, oh, my God, you're going to go far. Some people would say, oh, my God, I can see, you know, you will be our next Oprah, something like that. But somehow I would just hide. I would reach a level of success, and then I would sabotage myself. So that's the kind of debting that I am big into. I just want to take a moment and just thank DA because I've received many gifts of recovery. I have a regular PRG. My PRG team is the most gentle team, and I need so much gentility in my life. Thank you. I'm grateful for the relationship that I have with my son. You know, I've been in AA and Al-Anon for more than 17 years, and I've always known that race is an outside issue. But when I came into DA, I realized there's no way my race can be an outside issue, yeah, because I heard people, white people talk about trust funds and inheritances, and I'm like, what is that? What is a trust fund? I've never heard of anybody, no person of color that I know of has ever been a beneficiary of a trust fund or a large inheritance. No. Normally our parents just leave us a tiny little house and a lot of debt, and then we fight over this, you know? So I'm grateful for this. Thank you, Wendy. I heard that. I'm just going to wrap up. I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak about this, because when I did my first step, I realized I've never dealt with racism and the effect it has had on me. I'm currently on my step 7, and I know one of the first things that has to go on my step 8 list will be apartheid, will be racism, and it will be white privilege. Because whenever I bring up white privilege with white people, they deny it so strongly. And what happens is it re-traumatizes me. Because every time I wake up and I walk in white suburbs here in South Africa, it hurts me. It hurts like hell. And I don't know how to deal with this resentment. But I know there is a God, and my God is alive, and he wants me to be happy, prosperous, and free. And with that, I leave you, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Taraska, for your experience, strength, and hope. And thank you all to every speaker we've had so far today. Our tech host will now end the recording so that we can open up the room for sharing. Anyone sharing will not be recorded.
My name is Linda. I serve on UUOC. I am from a debtor from St. Petersburg, Florida, on the land of the Seminoles. Please join me in the serenity prayer by hitting *6 and unmuting. And you can say it with me. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
And now our tech host will mute.
Linda, go ahead and unmute yourself. Sorry about that.
Thank you. The Debtors Anonymous Manual of Service states, the mission of the Underserved and Underrepresented Outreach Caucus, the UUOC, is to support the fellowship in carrying the message of Debtors Anonymous to the debtor and the underserved populations and locations. We coordinate with World Service Conference committees and caucuses by developing best practice for doing the work and sharing it with DA as a whole. The purpose of this call is to create an opportunity to witness people's story around race and debt as we move towards being a more inclusive and accessible fellowship for all debtors. Today's program is broken up into 3-hour-long segments with 3 speakers in each segment. This is the second segment of the call. Speakers will be recorded, and the recording will be subsequently be available for debtorsanonymous.org podcast. After the speakers, we will have open sharing at the end of each hour. Open sharing will not be recorded. Open sharing will not be recorded. All callers have been placed on mute. Speakers each have 10 minutes to share. Our timekeeper for this segment is Kimberly, and she will give a warning at 5 minutes and 1 minute. The timekeeper will then mute all the people on the line, and you will get an unmute warning. Our speakers are Heather, Domingo, and France Luce. And so, Heather, if you're ready, welcome, Heather. Thank you for joining us, and we shall enjoy your message.
Thank you so much. Hi, I'm Heather, and I'm a debtor under earner, and I am so happy to have been asked to share today. I'm calling in from Lenape Lands on the East Coast, and my pronouns are she, they, and I was thinking about what I was going to share today, and I thought for some reason that this is like an all people of color meeting, so but I think the message still will work for all on the line. And I guess I was listening to the Serenity Prayer, and what really stuck out to me was the word courage. And I think this program has been a program of courage, because even though, you know, I came into 12-step through the Adult Children of Alcoholics program, the part that really sort of healed me was working on taking care of myself. And that's what I feel like Debtors Anonymous taught me how to do. And as a Black American, I come from a family of, I would say, you know, we were enslaved sharecroppers. And my father's side was enslaved. My mother's side was also enslaved, but they were like, they were religious. So like her father was a reverend. And so they did like lots of traveling, and they, so there was like this very spiritual side. And even though my father was a reverend, my grandfather was a reverend, he married my grandmother, who was like 13, and he was 25 or something. So there's all these like weird things like that kind of happened in my family, incest, and it's just a boundaryless family. And you know, one of our mottos is nothing comes easy. You have to work hard. And so being raised with that mentality, it was really hard for me to go after my dreams, or to even have a dream or a vision for myself. I really, I would like to say that today I can say that today I am living in my vision. I just wanted to start with that. Like, I'm, you know, working as an artist and getting paid for it. And I also have like a 9-to-5 job for healthcare, and I have, you know, the most money I've ever had in my savings in my life. It's like $16,000 in savings, and I have like $3,000 in my checking, and that's like after paying the rent. And so it feels like it's almost surreal, because I was always living through my credit cards. Like all my credit cards were maxed out, and that was sort of my lifestyle. And what really sort of helped my recovery would be doing service in VA. Like, I did a year as intergroup. I was like an intergroup chair, co-president and vice president. And so I did that for 2 years of service. And I mean, what I learned by doing that was that, you know, I can be a person of authority. And a lot of my story comes from being, feeling like I'm not enough, that I'm not a manager or someone who could be a leader. I, you know, because of all the sexual abuse and the physical abuse, I never really felt like I had any agency or that I could say anything. And most of my, you know, I grew up on military bases, and those were very white. And when my dad retired, we moved into a community that was really, it was like a large, I guess the largest middle class outside of Atlanta. of African American people, and so I had to, like, I was so not able to fit in with other people of my race, because I had been so homogenized. Like, I had, even though I was a black person in a white environment, when I became a black person who had mostly a white experience moving into a black people who were having black, oh, thank you, Kimberly. Black people who were having black experiences, it was like so shocking. So I was othered in this white community. And also I'm very masculine presenting butch black woman, you know, so I kind of always looked like this. So when I came into the 1980s, I was just, I felt like such an outsider inside my own community. So there was like this dissonance of like, I don't belong anywhere, and I was queer. And so it was very isolating. And I share all that to say, you know, I ended up carrying that sort of low self-esteem, worthlessness. I can't really get along. Like, nobody knows, you know, very feeling, what's the word we use in program? Like I felt very like, this is my story. No one else has this experience except for me, and no one will understand me. And so when I found Debtors Anonymous and just like realized that, this, my story is so much like everyone else, like, you know, it's very special to kind of grow up in a community that looks like you in America. And so lots of us have been isolated because of our race or the way we look or our sexuality. And so that sort of bringing a community in for me, and then having to share in the meetings really helped with my self-esteem. And like basically doing the numbers and doing the tools, I started to look at how I started taking numbers, and that's when the miracle started happening. And I really started connecting to a higher power that felt like a loving higher power and not like a punishing God. And I feel like when I started seeing the miracles for just like taking down my numbers is when I really could loosen up around my sense of like that it's like me against the world, which was like a big part of my personality, and being, you know, quite kind of like already seen as aggressive, even though I'm just a person existing, like my presence would create this, like I would come into rooms and there would be like a sense that like people, you know, weren't necessarily welcoming. And I had to like learn that it doesn't matter what the world, how the world sees me. Like what matters is that I'm showing up and God is my employer. And that's something that I've really taken from this program, is that I work for myself, no matter if I have a boss or not. And like, it's my, and that's sort of what I learned in DEA, is like, I keep my numbers. I don't go to, you know, eventually maybe I go to accountants, but like, you know, we work with PRGs. Like, I became Heather the business, you know, Heather the artist, not like, like I didn't have to go to, you know, my dad to ask him for help or can you explain this to me. Like, I really took leadership. Like, I found someone who knew it in program, and like, can you help me with an Excel sheet? And so, like, all of a sudden there was this agency to my life that superseded my like fear of being seen, fear of being, you know, not getting, like I was no longer living my life for like, I want this promotion, I want, you know, this car. But instead it was like, I'm going to show up today at work and be the best version of myself that I can be for myself. And then, you know, the raises started coming in, discrepancies started being found, I didn't get a promotion, but I got like, you know, a raise and recognized for the work I did. And I was like speaking up and making suggestions. And so,
One minute.
So I guess the way I want to wrap it up is around, you know, as a Black butch lesbian debtor, I was able to, like, I'm also a human being. And I mean, I know that we know that, but I think I say that in the sense of, like, I had to get past my own homophobia and fear of, like, oh, I don't belong in these spaces, you know? Like, I felt like I was sort of precluding myself or excluding myself from these spaces because I didn't see anyone else, like, be in the room. And now I'm just like, if there aren't other people that look like me in the room, I don't know if I want to be a part of this place. But also, like, if I'm going to be the first one in this room, I'm going to bring other people with me. And so a lot of my program, the way I live my life is like lifting other people up who wouldn't. If I get an opportunity to bring a person of color into a program that I'm doing, and so I feel like that was done for me, and that I want to do it for others. And Debtors Anonymous has really kind of given me the freedom to do that. And the more successful, it's like not only can I be successful, I can also help others pursue and achieve their dreams. So thank you so much for letting me share today. I pass.
Thank you, Heather, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And I'm sure people got a lot out of that idea. So now our next speaker is Domingo. Welcome, Domingo. You may begin.
Hi, this is Domingo, compulsive debtor. Can I be heard okay? My audio quality?
Yes, we can hear you.
Awesome. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Domingo. I'm a compulsive debtor, under-earner, and business owner, and recovering in this program along with all you beautiful, fine folks. And I never planned my shares, but I thought because this was a specific topic, I should do some writing. And then in doing my, and I'm a storyteller, so in doing writing, I just realized there's too much that I could share with you in regards to race and, you know, race and DA. So instead of speeding up and trying to squeeze it all in 10 minutes, I'm really just going to slow down and take my time because I realized today that, you know, for today, my commitment is to not incur debt, and that's in all aspects of my life. Debting for me, you know, I learned early on that it's not just incurring new unsecured debt. I had to open it up to a sort of a wider definition. And for me, debting is when I make a decision or sign an agreement or enter into an agreement or a relationship where I get less than what I give, much like incurring new unsecured debt, where in the moment, in my desperation, in my feeling of lack, of needing something, I will make an agreement that will put me in the future further behind than when I made that agreement. Yes, I may be getting $1,000 today from that credit card company, but then I'm going to have to pay them back, you know, $3,000, three times as much, or, you know, when I pay them back. And that's part of the blindness of debting, my blindness to the negative effects of my debting and the blindness to abundance that I have. So I want to talk a little bit about who I am, just so you have some kind of reference. I identify as Chicano. I'm 53 years old, so Latino, the word Latino is still to me I think there's Latinx now. So that's all like super new, something I don't necessarily identify with because it's just, it's Chicano, it's LA. I grew up in Bull Heights, and that is directly east of LA. Don't ask me why I like to make this distinction, but I like to say that yes, it's east of LA, but not East LA. If you are ever in Los Angeles and you go across any one of the bridges across from the city of LA toward east bound, over the Alley River, the First Street Bridge, a Fourth Street Bridge, or one of those bridges, you'll likely drive into Boyle Heights, and that's where I was born and raised. And so that's where my identity comes from, and that's where I learned a sense of lack. I learned that I learned a limiting beliefs that, you know, I still am parsing out even today. But this last job that I had, I was making more money than I've ever made. And I voluntarily left that job, not a rush decision. I did it with preparation. And as a result of being in DA, I've been in DA since 2009 and worked in the DA How concept since 2011. And my recommitment date is January 5th, 2017. So the limiting beliefs, you know, I grew up hearing stories from my dad that they lived on the banks of the Alley River back when it was a river, and how when the storms would come, the houses that lived there, you know, wasn't a choice spot to live. You know, being riverfront property in the Alley River was not as choice as it sounded, because it would overrun its banks and houses would get swept away. But that's where he lived, and he would have to go to school with baggy pants, so he would hide the fact that he didn't have shoes. He would go to school barefooted. So that's kind of what I heard and grew up. And we didn't have a lot of money. My father, I love him, but he was a good example of making the best with what you had. However, living on what for me now seems like an unsustainable life. He was a single earner, he had seven children, and with a very modest income. And he did the best he could. We had a little side. Thank you. He had a little side business. He actually saved his money. He was really good saving his money, but there's only so much you can save. He built some apartments in the back. So, you know, we grew up with actually a lot more than a lot of people had in my community. It's a, you know, there's a very heavy Hispanic, mostly Mexican American community. And, you know, we had a home and apartments we rented, although most of them were for family members, and most of them, I remember, I think the rent was like 300 and something a month for like two bedrooms. So in the 80s, which I don't know if that was, it just seemed low to me. So needless to say, when I left this last job, I thought, you know, one of the limiting beliefs that I had was that I can only make a certain amount of money. So when I redid my vision board and I realized that the vision that I had for my income was, you know, $150,000. And I thought that's not, you know, it's only, I thought to myself, that's not possible. Then I realized I've had a lot of aha moments since going, being in self-employed. One of them is this idea of limiting beliefs, that no one is saying I cannot earn $150,000. And not only that, In accepting that realization that I'm the one putting that limiting belief on myself, that $150,000 may actually be pretty low in terms of my skill set and what the value that I can bring, you know, in the work that I do. I'm actually starting a business as a result of DA. Listen to this. As a personal finance coach, I laugh because so I don't cry of what a miracle it is. I've also started a bookkeeping business, and I'm preparing taxes. And it just so happens that this past year, I paid off my tax debt this year, 2021. So I don't believe I would have even had the opportunity to go into preparing taxes, because I think, I'm not sure if you can do it with a tax debt. So, and that's all as a result of DA, because prior to DA, you know, living in my car, bouncing checks, not even having credit, you know, hiding out. What is it, 8 years, 10 years while your credit gets clean? You know, that's what I was doing. I was hiding out till my credit got clean. So what can I say in the last maybe a couple of minutes that I have? The limit on ideas, the blindness to abundance. I just recently, the last job I had, I negotiated my severance pay, which is a miracle. Because for me, it's a miracle that I didn't just sign it and just like take it to them in person and just, you know, thank them and before they change their mind that they're giving me, you know, so much money for basically free or for gratitude. Instead, I was able to talk to people. I was able to seek out different feedback, and I was able to attempt to, you know, I made a counteroffer and negotiated with them. And then during my discovery session with other DA members, I had a friend said, oh, I had a lawyer friend, and he helped me out to compose the letter. And then I, while she's talking, I was thinking, I wish I had a lawyer friend that could help me out. But 5 minutes after I got off that phone call with that friend, I realized that I have a brother who graduated from Columbia University in New York and has been a corporate lawyer for, 10, 15 years. But the blindness, I have it. I have abundance in my own family, and I'm trying not to cry here. So, thank you. And I can't see it, and that's the limiting beliefs, and that's specifically coming from, you know, where I came from, where there was even classisms within my classmates. You know, you couldn't be a Tijuanero. They called us. They called people who were too Mexican. Anyways, I don't have a whole lot of time, but just that blindness of abundance, the limiting ideas, and just not even having the logistics of growing up in a family and environment that has a lot of financial resources. I've had, you know, but DA has been fantastic. The one thing I will say, not just in DA, but in all 12 steps, is it is a safe space for me. And I have not felt any type of, you know, that I'm different. I'm a debtor like everyone else, or I'm something else. But that unity is the key for the program. And I feel like it's almost not the real world, but it's my real world. It's the world that I take in my heart into the real world, quote unquote, real world. This idea that we're all equal and we're just trying to help each other out and no one is better or less than the other person. Somebody may have more knowledge in one aspect, but I may have more knowledge to share with them and help be able to help them out in another. You know, the idea of giving and receiving, doing service, and being given service, it's just the door, and it goes both ways, and it's equally valuable to give than to receive. And I like to practice that in my daily. So thanks for allowing me to share, and I love all you guys. I pass.
Thank you, Domingo. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, and great share. Appreciate you sharing your story. And so now, is France Luce on the line, available?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Hi, I am France Luce. I'm a debtor and under-earner, gratefully recovering. My pronouns are she, her. I'm based in Los Angeles, in the Tongva land. And I'm grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Heather and Domingo. It was so lovely to hear your qualifications. And I don't know if there are newcomers on this. I'm still a little unclear about who is on this call, but if there are any newcomers, welcome. This program works. It's amazing. If there are any newcomers, or anyone for that matter, on the call that is feeling really in despair and feeling that a sense of hopelessness, I've been there. When I first came into this program, I was still living in New York many years ago, and most of the meetings were predominantly white, which was a challenge for me, but I was so desperate. I had a really low bottom, and it was mostly under earning, but I came into the program months behind in rent, behind in all my bills. I was, you know, not opening envelopes, avoiding my landlord, living in extreme deprivation. You know, I mean, there were weeks where I was eating oatmeal and cabbage every day. And I always tell this story when I'm asked to qualify. I remember the first few meetings I went to was winter, and I had a really cheap winter coat that I think I bought for like $20, and it was like three sizes too big for me. The zipper was broken. I would have to step in and out of it. I was counting change in my pockets every day. I mean, I had a very low bottom. And today, I live in Los Angeles. I'm a writer. I'm in my vision. I write for a television series. I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life. I'm also a playwright. I've been a playwright for most of my career, and I moved to LA a few years ago because my vision was to write for TV. And so today I'm writing for a TV series, and I have a new play in production. I have a world premiere of a new play opening in a couple of weeks. And I just bought a new car. I didn't need any help to pay for it. It's a 2022 brand new. And it's all just this program, honestly. I have a pressure man now. My current pressure man once told me that if I keep my numbers every day without fail, my life will change in ways I can't imagine. And that is true. That's the first thing I did way back when I first came into DA with my broken coat. The first thing people told me was, somebody said, get a notebook. This is how long I've been in program. This is like before smartphones and apps. Somebody said, get a notebook and start writing down your numbers. And that was the first thing I did. And then it was just one day at a time. You know, eventually I got a pressure meeting. Eventually I got a sponsor. I've been through several sponsors. And I've gotten... each one of them were a gift, and I feel like I've had the sponsor that I needed in every phase of my recovery. And I will say that my sponsor today is a white man, which I would have never, I couldn't have guessed, but our sponsor-sponsee relationship developed in the most organic way, and I love him. It's one of the most important relationships in my life today, and I'm really grateful. And you know, that's another gift of this program. You know, one of the traditions is principles before personalities, and when I can. When I can get out of my own way and just let my higher power in and surrender completely to my higher power, I can let go of all the things that keep me from being solvent, happy, joyous, and free. And that includes my resentment towards towards other people, places, and things, particularly those that are connected to white supremacy, you know. And I can acknowledge that that exists and that has had that has impacted my ability to earn, but that my higher power is bigger than white supremacy, and my higher power is bigger than racism. I can't, you know, I can surrender all of that to my higher power. and just a little bit about where I'm from. Both of my parents are from Haiti. I was born in Africa, but for those who don't know, you know, Haiti was the first independent black nation. It was the first successful slave insurrection. We gained our independence from enslavement in 1804. But France and United States and Great Britain would not acknowledge Haiti as an independent nation unless we repaid a debt to France for lost property, and that lost property was us, the humans. And it was the equivalent, I think it's like $400 billion, something like that was the equivalent. And it took over 100 years for Haiti to pay that debt back. And I always share that because, you know, I come from a country, my entire family, you know, our ancestors come from this legacy of debt that we incurred in the most cruel, inhumane, unjust way. And that's something that I think has trickled down. You know, it's a kind of intergenerational trauma that, I mean, I can speak for myself, that I've gained a lot of awareness about in my recovery, and that is part of my healing, and I'm so grateful. Like I never felt. I mean, once I became aware of how it's impacted me, I didn't always feel like there was a place in these rooms to share about that. And so I'm so grateful now that there are meetings like this, that there are BIPOC meetings. When I first came into DA, I didn't know of any BIPOC meetings, and now there are so many. Like, I can choose which BIPOC meetings I want to go to. That's such a gift. Yeah, and so I grew up, we grew up, you know, middle class, although, you know, my parents, especially my father, made me feel like we didn't have any money. There was a lot of fear about money. Everything was always too expensive. You know, my father was really frugal, and so I took a lot of that on. I just grew up always believing that there wasn't enough, and that I wasn't allowed to want things. I wasn't allowed to treat myself. You know, everything was about survival. That's a lot of the mentality that I grew up with. Which is sad because my father was actually incredibly successful. Thank you. And I don't know if he truly enjoyed the abundance that he created for himself and our family, because he was actually quite successful, and we were always taken care of and well provided for. And so, I don't know, my last few seconds, what do I want to share? I'll just express my gratitude that I don't have to live that way today. I get to feel free to want things. I am free to treat myself, to celebrate my accomplishments. And to live free of fear and anxiety around money. And it's one day at a time. I still have to work on it. I have to surrender every day, but every day I get to experience that freedom. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you. Franceluce, great share. Thank you for your experience, strength, and hope. And I appreciate you being with us. thank you all of you, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Our tech host will now end the recording portion of the meeting, and we will go into the sharing part of the meeting.
All right. Welcome to today's fellowship-wide call, Race and Debt, Experience, Strength, and Hope, presented by the Debtors Anonymous Underserved and Underrepresented Outreach Caucus, the UUOC. My name is Deborah O. I serve on the UUOC, and I am a compulsive debtor calling you from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm on Wampanoag and Nipmuc people's land. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. You can press star 6 to unmute. God,
grant us the courage to change the thing, the wisdom to know the difference.
Okay, we will now put all callers on mute again to silence. The Debtors Anonymous Manual of Service states, the mission of the Underserved and Underrepresented Outreach Caucus, the UUOC, is to support the fellowship in carrying the message of Debtors Anonymous to the debtor in underserved populations and locations. We coordinate with World Service Conference committees and caucuses by developing best practices for doing that work and sharing it with DA as a whole. The purpose of this call is to create an opportunity to witness people's stories around race and debt as we move towards being a more inclusive and accessible fellowship for all debtors. Today's call will be broken up into 3-hour long segments with 3 speakers in each segment. This is the 3rd segment of the call today. Speakers will be recorded and the recording will subsequently be available at debtorsanonymous.org/podcast. After the speakers, we will have open sharing at the end of each hour. Open sharing will not be recorded. All callers have been placed on mute. Speakers each have 10 minutes to share. Our timekeeper for this segment is Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen, you're on the call. And she will give a time warning at 5 minutes and 1 minute. Okay. Mary Ellen, just confirming you're here.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you. Great to hear your voice. Okay, so our first speaker is James H. And welcome, James H. Glad to have you. You may begin.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you to the timekeeper and everyone that's here and everyone who did service to make this happen. My name is James H. I'm a compulsive debtor. I placed my last debt back in October 2017. I just want to say, yes, yeah, an honor and a privilege to do service and Underserved, Underrepresented Outreach Caucus presents Race and Debt. That's a lot to take in. Yeah. Okay, so 9 minutes and some change. I'm a compulsive debtor, and I just want to thank Debtors Anonymous for being here for me because Debtors Anonymous has changed my life for the better. When I came into Debtors Anonymous, I was poolside for a while, and it is what it is. But when I finally got plugged in, and when I did that first PRG, and they told me, like, let's just say I owed one creditor $15,000, which was around the amount I owed American Express for putting season Brooklyn Nets tickets on an Amex credit card, you're going to send them $25 a month and stuff like that. I really grieved a lot because I knew I had to surrender that credit score. That credit score meant everything to me growing up. Credit was a step up. Like, to have access to credit was, to me, like hitting the lottery. And I remember getting my Bloomingdale's credit card. It was $500 back in the mid-90s, and I spent the $500 on the spot, and you couldn't tell me anything. But I surrendered that credit score when I started. I knew I surrendered to Debtors Anonymous when I gave up the credit score, pretty much. And I started, you know, taking the suggestions of my PRG and sending payments out. And one of the things was I would like to get a passport and travel the world. That was one of the things back in 2017. I was working for a company that I had access to hotels internationally and locally. So I mentioned that because fast forward next week, solvently, I'm going on a vacation, a family vacation with my wife and my child, who both I didn't have prior to coming into DA. And I'm doing it solvently and seeing my son, who's 9 months old, have a passport, bust my heart open, and I get emotional about it because we didn't go on family vacations. If anything, we probably went to Coney Island or Wright Playland. And here I am solvently with my family going to an international vacation, staying in a very abundant suite overlooking the Caribbean Sea, solvently. That's a lot for me to take in. And I'm just grateful. There's something about the, I'm starting to venture over to POC meetings in a way because there's something missing in my recovery that I've learned to just deal with or disassociate from, which is how debt impacts me as a person of color. It really does. It really does. And for me, it's been about grieving, persevering, and acknowledging. And slowly but surely, I'm starting to accept that, like, my crash course is a lot tougher as a Black person, person of color, especially also as a debtor. And I have tons of people that are not people of color in my life who I love dearly. But I hope me taking a stand for my recovery on a deeper level doesn't scare them away. But if it does, then I let higher power take care of that. But I need to acknowledge that, yeah, you know, it's really real as a Black man in this world. Black always bottom of totem pole, no matter what, no matter how you slice it. And that's just the honest truth. Always on the bottom. And then Black woman, oof. The last thing I wanted to do was date a dark-skinned Black woman because that reminded me of my home, which was riddled with shame, pain. Man, I always said, light is right, lighter, brighter. I had a woman tell me one time, you would be a dime if you were light-skinned. So I just knew how that plays out. I learned to be the only Black person and kind of like be okay with that. The only Black person in the Hamptons at this time, the only Black person at this job, the only Black person in the play. I learned how to be the only Black person. That's effed up. I don't want my 9-month-old son to have to live in that manner. And I didn't know how to negotiate. I didn't know, I mean.
That's 5 minutes, James.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. If I'm going by society's rules, I'm breaking all the rules because I didn't get into I didn't start college until I was like 26 and, you know, dropped out because of stuff. But anyway, right now, just to fast forward, just being married to a dark-skinned Black woman. I just want to say that. I'm not saying that to be different or like rah, rah, rah. I'm just saying that I'm able to see the beauty that I was blinded not to see before. I would actually, poof. And I mentioned that because it has to do with race and it has to do with debt. By me, I'm debting when I don't see the beauty in my Blackness. And I learned how to go through life seeing the hatred. I hated being Black. You know, and plus, now I had two parents who both died from heroin overdoses. I was 8 years old when I tried waking my beautiful mom up from a heroin overdose, and she didn't wake up. So I got the message early on in life. God doesn't love me. I'm in this ghetto in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, during the height of the crack cocaine epidemic. Now it looks like Madison, Wisconsin over there. And when I go over there, I cry and I grieve. But when I was growing up there, I was shut down. I would wait for everyone to leave the bodega so I could use my food stamps. And Poppy would say, what's wrong, Papito? Papito. I said, Poppy, the guy working behind the store, I say Poppy. But he's like, Papito, call me Papito. What's wrong? What are you? I would wait for everyone to leave the store so I could use my food stamp. I just felt so much shame around being poor, black, and in the ghetto. And I started early on, 11, 12 years old, hustling in the streets, from packing bags to pumping gas to eventually selling crack cocaine to eventually almost losing my life, to having to go into a therapeutic community, to giving a speech at the White House, having tea with the President of the United States because of my story, to ending up back in crack houses, to gambling, everything. All of these ways I learned how to debt. And I learned early on to love myself was to abandon myself. That's the message I got from God. I felt like I would call up to God and he would disconnect the phone on me. So I learned how to become self-sufficient by any means necessary. It's taken me decades to develop a relationship with God. And it's crucial that I own my story, and it's crucial that I come from a place of that I acknowledge that five-year-old or that eight-year-old little boy who was trying to wake his mom up. Because if I don't do that, and then I'm deading. If I don't honor, and I love my Nana who was 15, who was 14 when she had my mother. My mother was 15 when she had me. I can only imagine what kind of issues a 15-year-old black young lady was going through to put needles in her arm. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. So fast forward, I'm dealing with a lot of trauma around race, and debting was a solution. And it's painful sometimes. You know, I'll just say in recovery, I was able to make amends to my family and my Nana, who, God bless my Nana. God bless that woman. She was a maid. She screwed up people's floors.
You have a minute, James?
Thank you. She did what she had to do to put food on her table for her two little grandchildren, who she wasn't expecting to raise because her only daughter died from a heroin overdose. God bless that woman. Sometimes I do therapy. I feel like I'm going against her, or it's hard for me to acknowledge because I do a lot of adult child work too. So it's sometimes I feel like I'm disparaging her, but at the same time, I acknowledge her beauty and her pain and her journey for being there for us. It was just, I mean, to borrow money to put food on the table. I've seen my grandmother with other men to put food on the table for us. Yeah. That's a lot. That's a lot. And then to say, oh, that's an outside issue, really? Okay. Anyway, I think my time is up. So I'll just say I'm really grateful. I feel like I'm just getting started. I have so much love to give and so much love to grieve. And to take the love in is very painful for me. So as my life continues to get big, as it does, I need to stay close.
Yes, James, that is time.
Thank you. When it gets bigger, I tend to shut down and do self-harming behaviors. Because as I mentioned earlier, to love myself was to abandon myself. So I want to do that less and less. Thank you. That's my time. What an awesome time on this talk today. Thank you for letting me share. Pass.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope today. And now our next speaker is Zoe. Welcome, Zoe. Glad to have you. And you may begin.
Hi, my name is Zoe. Can I be heard?
Yes, you can.
Great. Thank you so much. Grateful to be here. I'm Zoe. I'm a debtor, under-earner, and business owner. Thank you to James. Really beautiful chair, and it's gotten me a little verklempt just even thinking about it. So just want to give thanks and just say praise be to God. that we get to recover together. So my pronouns are she, her. I'm on Lenape land, also known as New York City, and I am a second-generation Korean-American. My parents emigrated in the 60s, met here, had me in Queens, and, you know, as I've had an awakening around this issue around race and debt in the last couple of years, and, you know, I have to trace it back to my original family story of alcoholism, neglect, and abuse. You know, in the 70s, we were, you know, under a lot of pressure to be model minority. And the messages that I got, which were inextricably linked together, were really, you know, don't talk about your dad's alcoholism, like pretend that everything's okay, and to pretend to be white. And that I was white adjacent, that I was to think white thoughts and to be the only person of color in the room, to put my head down, study hard, be successful, go to an Ivy League college, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so much of that actually, you know, came to pass and served me, but, you know, I had this disease, and that it's a hereditary disease, and that, you know, that I couldn't really escape, you know, the unfinished business of my dad's alcoholism and being an adult child, and how that manifested was through debting and under-earning. The most baffling, you know, kind of sequence of events, because I considered myself, you know, the savior of the family and the person that was going to be successful and the savior, all of that, and yet the disease still got me, and it was so baffling. Like, it was this question of, if I'm so smart, why is my life so stupid? And why am I 3 months behind on my rent? And why is the Con Ed, the electricity being turned off? And why am I standing online at this pay center to, you know, get my electricity turned back on? Like, what, it just didn't make any sense, right? So I came into DA in 2004. So, I'm going to say that I'm coming up on my 18-year anniversary in a couple of months, and that, you know, the bizarre and baffling nature of the disease all of a sudden made all of these question marks go away, and everything started to make sense, because the problem was not me, the problem was my disease, and that no matter what it looked like on paper, it was ultimately that I had a spiritual problem. And, you know, I give thanks to God that I kept coming back, because I've noticed in this program that there is a trajectory where, you know, we call it up, up, and away, where, you know, people come into crisis, things get better, and then, you know, people dip out, and, you know, it's everybody's got a different path and story, but one of the things that was important to me was to keep coming back, and I really urge any newcomer to keep coming back, because it's a program filled with miracles. And there's a saying, you know, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle, and don't quit 5 minutes after the miracle. And I'm a living testimony to say that, you know, the miracles come, and the cash and prizes come, and the spiritual awakenings come, and then there's kind of this period of stasis, and then more miracles happen, and unexpected things that are almost unimaginable, and visions coming true beyond one's wildest dreams, and, you know, not how I conceptualized it, but better than I imagined, and more perfect than I imagined. And so just to affirm that HP's ideas are better than my ideas.
5 minutes, Zoe.
Thank you. So I just want to say that I'm currently on step 10, and it's my second trip through the steps. I've had three really incredible sponsors. The first time I worked the steps, It was on the numbers, and the second time I started working the steps, which is my current round, I'm working the steps on relationships. And, you know, I get to be a whole person in this program. And one of the things that the first round of steps actually showed me was that I actually didn't have a problem with the numbers. My main problem was with resentments, and the resentments are deadly. The resentments primarily against institutions, both individuals and institutions, but, you know, just to say that, you know, all of the things that are deemed outside issues in the world, you know, created this pool of rage inside of me and this kind of impotent rage that I just carried around with me all the time. And direct experiences of racism, you know, being called names and bamboo ceiling stuff and existing within a caste where it was like, well, I'm number two, but I can never be number one. And that if I tried to assert my leadership, then I would get slapped down and punished for that because my job was to just support the person who was calling the shots and do all the scut work and hide in the background. And that's actually a socially assigned role. That's not a role that I would give to myself. And so to recognize that and also to say, I don't know where my disease starts and those types of interpersonal dynamics that are rooted in white supremacy begin. Like I don't actually have the ability to tell the difference between, you know, what that is and what's really happening in terms of my disease. And the only way that I can alleviate it is through working the steps. And primarily through steps 4 and 5, you know, when I realized that my problem was with resentments and that they were killing me, I had to learn how to take that poison of resentment out of myself and release it to my higher power. And I will say that resentment kills, and that it freezes me into this kind of suspended animation where I'm not effectual, and I want to be effective and of service to my community. So step 10 is really about ever increasing in understanding and effectiveness. And what that looks like for me today is that I am a resource to my community. I am in a position to be generous, both with my time, my knowledge, my love, my financial resources. I've gotten a lot of cash and prizes in this program, and that has enabled me to support projects and people that deserve support, that are BIPOC, that have had all the, you know, everything stacked against them. So I will say that every time I level up, I find that there's a new set of challenges and a new set of miracles that are awaiting me. And that it is absolutely essential to keep squeaky clean spiritually. And that's really my number one job today.
You have a minute, Zoe?
Okay. It's not about me increasing my income or, you know, getting bragging rights. It's really about how can I be of greater and greater service every day. And I just want to put out that I have a vision. And it kind of circles back to this idea of being, you know, being the only person of color in the room. I've done so many meetings, business meetings, where I'm the only person of color in the room besides the cater waiters, you know, and that how painful that is to, you know, be between two worlds and to really identify with the cater waiters. And yet, you know, have this pantomime of being part of this group that are, you know, have a lot of leverage, actually, and are policymakers. And so I just want to say that one of the things that I really want to be doing in the future is to be, thank you. I'll just wrap by saying that I really want to be a part of a team that is all BIPOC and to be in BIPOC leadership and BIPOC governance. And that's a vision that I hold for myself. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Zoe. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope today. And now our third speaker in this segment is Carlton. Welcome, Carlton. We're so glad to have you here, and you may begin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Carlton. I'm a grateful, recovering, compulsive debtor and also an under-earner. And so good to be here to tune in with everybody. And I'll get a little timer going here for myself, too, just so I can stay on it, even though I know you're going to give warnings. Yeah, when I was growing up, I'm multiracial, and I didn't know what my racial makeup was. I just knew I was the only brown kid in the trailer park, and I developed a sense of humor around that. To the best of my ability, you know, I used humor to just make another spin on things and try to figure out, like, how is this workable? I mean, I see these people around me who are racist and they're white, and some of them are racist towards me and some of them are really friendly towards me. Some of them I can make laugh and we can just sort of laugh about stuff that we all have in common, and other people are, you know, like I said, angry or racist and, you know, want to make distance between us and are using my color of my skin as a reason. I would see things on TV. I had all white friends when I was young, and I didn't have my first cohort of all black friends until I was 19, when I joined the United States Army. And it was very, very bizarre to hang out exclusively with black people at such an advanced age. You know, I felt like there was something I really wanted to be a part of. I was a part of them, and I was multiracial. Different people, you know, some guys had white blood in them too, and some guys were all black. And I think the main thing I learned from that, spending lots of time with white people when they were by themselves, and there was a spy in their midst, but they didn't really think about me being there or being black. And then being with black people for years as an adult with no white people around, except for any white blood I had in me or one of my other friends, let's say, had white blood in them, was that the white people were not plotting constantly to destroy black people. And the black people were not plotting constantly to destroy white people. Both groups, from my observation, were living their lives. They were just trying to live their lives. I do feel wholeheartedly that I live in a system that is skewed and is rooted in white supremacy and is rooted in some enormous early injustices. You know, debt for me, okay, I mean, my ancestors on my black side were part of America's first debt, the first debt to humanity, the first debt to a culture, to a race of people was made by enslaving a race of people and making them the labor for America's treasury, the greatest original resource that this country had were the backs and legs and muscles and sinew and bodies and psyches of my African ancestors. And debt for me is what I've come to realize after 20 years in this program, is that debt for me is an addiction to other people's resources. I'm addicted to other people's resources. So something really interesting happens when I think of the whole picture. Okay, so I see that the original, you know, crime was to make use of other people's resources, that is, my African ancestors. And yet, we come forward 400 years, and I still have the same inclination. So that helps me begin to see that there is an evil corrosive thread that, you know, anyone could be susceptible to, and it helps me move towards unity and forgiveness and moving past this. The one thing I will say that has been just unbelievable to me is that anybody would call my relationship with my race and debting an outside issue. And I've heard, you know, race, an outside issue, you know. And I knew something was wrong with people saying that in the meetings, you know. And I'm glad that that's changing. I'm glad that the World Service Conference has said that race is no longer an outside issue. It is ridiculous to suggest that, in my opinion. I mean, I think I have different associations with it than people that, let's say, are not of color, not people of color. Different associations with outside issue. Because when I think of outside issue, I think of slaves living in outbuildings, you know, not allowed in the main house, without a vote. My ancestors on my African side were outside. Again, outside the body politic, not able to vote, no voice, outside houses, outside the body politic. So when I hear that race is an outside issue, you know, I say no. I say, well, what about the program says it's an inside job? And I believe that, you know, while I'm stretching the metaphor, I believe that it is an inside job. And what goes on in my past and what goes on with me psychologically from my past is no different than when I hear a person that's not a person of color saying, well, my parents were bad with money. Or, you know, my grandparents were abusive and they abused me with money. You know, or even if somebody says I was poor, someone that's not a person of color talking about the poverty in their childhood. Personal history is important. Debt is slavery. Debt is slavery. And so I'm not the only one that's been a part of, you know, debt as a brown-skinned person. I'm not the only one who has an ancestry of slavery. I have a current issue with being inclined to become indentured to institutions. And I feel like we have this in common. You know, I feel like we, as a person who is has both bloodstreams running through me, I have always needed, so that I could live, to see commonality in a way forward. I remember when I was young, I would see things on TV. You know, this is part of, like, how does this ancestry, how does this filter that I went through life with, how does it impact the way I think of myself and my earning and class and what's possible? You know,
you have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you so much. Thank you. There's a song in a musical, Old Man River. It starts with the line, colored folks work on the Mississippi. Colored folks work while the white folks play. Now, that song is written by a white person. And it's been thought for years that that was a Negro spiritual because it so gets at the heart of what I have seen. And I see it, I see people today, I saw it 40 years ago. I see people of color working jobs in fast food, they're serving people, they're care providers, they're in service positions. It's not that I don't see white people there, but I see a preponderance of those roles being filled by people of color. That impacts me. It impacts what I think is possible. That impact. I used to watch Saturday morning cartoons. All the heroes were white. That's just it. They're white. They're heroes. They're white dudes and white ladies. That's just what it is. That's it. That stuff impacts me. And it makes my heart beat in a very erratic way to think that someone would say that experience would be an outside issue. The adrenaline starts pumping. I'm incredulous. And I think of, you know, and I'm so glad that things are coming around, you know, and things are changing and justice, you know, it takes a long time for things to balance out. I'll finish with this, you know. You know, my ancestors on my black side did not get a vote until 1965. A vote! So it's particularly triggering when something happens at World Service that involves voting and maneuvering starts to happen to sort of preserve the squelching of that voice. It's really painful to experience that. And so for 350 years, there was no vote, no voice. But then there was. And things have, you know, we could say the needle has moved some. In DA, you know, DA existed for 45 years before we're now talking about this being, that this is a relevant topic. 45 years. It took
that
AA.
Carlton.
Thank you. I'll just finish up. Took AA 82 years. I'm left hopeful that maybe things are moving in the right direction. And I'll just, the final thing I'll say is that when people talk about assets and generational wealth, I don't identify. This is one other way that I'm different. I don't have generational wealth. Many of my people on my African side do not have generational wealth, and it's difficult sometimes. I have to adjust my ears when I hear people talking about being flat broke, but they're talking about they have $20,000 left. When I'm talking about being flat broke, I'm talking about being broke down to the penny. So there are a lot of differences and a lot of adjustments that I need to make on both sides, you know, for myself, because I live in that line that rides the middle. And I'm grateful for that because it forces me to see both sides because I am both sides. Thank you, and I hope this was helpful. Grateful to be solvent, grateful to be part of the program.
Thank you, Carlton. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope today. And thank you to all our speakers today. Thank you very much. Our tech host now will end the recording so we can open up the room for shares. Anyone sharing will not be recorded.